So you go down this cliff, go left down the cliff, left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
When a competent observer looks for signs of despotism in a community, he looks beyond fine words and noble phrases.
It's society. They work for each other. They pay each other. They buy houses. They get married and make children. That just sounds like slavery with extra steps.
Go into the automobile business and compete with the auto trust. Can I go into the grocery business and compete with the chain stores? Not a chance. Monopoly is the menace of free enterprise.
Because it's just a big money-making machine. They're wandering through a maze of inauthentic, fake landscapes, and they can't escape.
The message in all this is that the capitalist system in America is unfair and is, in fact, a failure at providing for basic human needs or maintaining continued national growth.
I can't wait for, like, the episode of, like, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire, where all the contestants, like, team up and they overpower the host and they share the money.
Bottom-up horizontal connection is sharing at all levels, not top-down control.
We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Because as communities go, so goes the nation.
Anyway, here's video games.
There's been a lot of talk about unionization in the game industry over the past few months, the closure of Telltale Games and the resulting revelation that overworked staff wouldn't be getting money they were owed made the concept of an organized workforce in video games too important to ignore. Telltale, for those who don't remember, closed down, owing quite a few employees quite a bit of money, a fact made worse by the studio's embrace of crunch culture, where workers were expected to stay late on rushed projects, with some staff working through the night, often having to stay in the office until 2 a.m. at least. Since then, people have been more sensitive than ever to the treatment of employees in the game industry, which is a good thing. I mean, the sensitivity is a good thing, not the treatment of workers, which can actually be quite a bad thing, depending on the studio. Rockstar was blasted for boasting of 100-hour work weeks in the development of Red Dead Redemption 2, while BioWare was rightly raked over the coals for perpetuating the myth of BioWare magic, the idea that a game can be an unfocused, meandering mess, so long as everything comes together in the hurried, stressful final months.
It's not mismanagement, it's BioWare magic!
Stories of horrifying crunch have also emerged from Netherrealm and Epic Games, with yet more reports of developers being worked to the bone. Meanwhile, Activision Blizzard notoriously jettisoned 800 staff members at the exact same time it boasted of record revenue. Stories of overworked developers and mass layoffs in massively successful companies are alarmingly regular, but after years of going unchallenged, publishers are finally getting the skewering they deserve from press and public alike. Few things make a better case for a union than an industry without one. The mainstream game industry, despite wanting nothing to do with a union, actually justifies the concept of one through its sheer existence. The routine, calculated way in which it exploits its workers mirrors the routine, calculated way in which it exploits its customers. And if companies like Riot Games get their way, we won't even get to hear about it. Riot Games, if you didn't know, is the studio behind League of Legends, one of many games that got super popular and became a gigantic hit among live streamers and YouTubers, so naturally I never got into it because every mainstream hit seems to pass me by, and that's one of roughly 18 reasons why I am unpopular in this business. Riot was drenched in controversy last year when Kotaku ran an expose based on interviews with dozens of current and former employees, detailing a culture of sexism, and in some cases, straight-up harassment. Depending on who you ask, Riot Games is either a great place to work or a suppressive nightmare, and I believe both portrayals of the company to be true depending on perspective. Indeed, some of the worst places I've worked also had plenty of staff who were treated just fine depending on who they were friends with or what they did, and sometimes I was the one who thought a company was great because I was treated well, only to see others later complain about how they got fucked over. In any case, the stories that emerged from Riot's work environment were disturbing. Women have reportedly been passed over for promotion and had their ideas ignored until said ideas were presented by men. In job interviews, women are said to have been grilled extra harshly to discover their credibility as a nebulously defined core gamer, with one story stating that such core gamers need to play, and I quote, real games like Call of Duty. Some darker allegations involve reports of women receiving unsolicited dick pics from colleagues, being put on lists detailing which women the guys would like to fuck, and at least one woman getting her potential promotion halted after refusing the advances of a male higher-up at a party. Riot's been accused of encouraging a bro culture that negatively impacts men and women alike, with Riot COO Scott Gelb explicitly named as an infantile and abusive vector of toxicity. He has been accused of grabbing at other men by the balls, jokingly humping against co-workers without their permission, and farting on people. In response, Riot would suspend Gelb without pay for 2 months and has promised to do better in future, attempting to positively address its approach to diversity and fair treatment. But like my old grandmother used to say, you can't just pop a fart back up a COO's anus, especially when Riot has recently caught more heat for trying to stop its workforce having its day in court. A lot of the story surrounding Riot grimly sounds like a typical bro-led tech startup, the type of overtly casual meritocracy of ideas and free spirit that sounds good in theory, but rarely translates to a workplace that makes practical long-term sense. An overwhelming majority of male workers with their in-studio coffee shop and campus grounds, a culture more akin to a college fraternity than a real workplace, where people get heard by shouting down their colleagues, and indeed where a top executive can think nothing is wrong with sexually assaulting people for a joke. The problem with all of these frat-style startups that we hear about so often these days is simple. Animal House is a fun film. It's not a viable corporate structure. One thing stood out to me regarding the Riot allegations, and it's something that stood out in so many stories of work environments within game development, and that's the culture of silence that the industry overall has insidiously cultivated. Riot has a non-disparagement clause for anyone who leaves the company, essentially stating you can't shit on the company after you leave it. I know what those look like, because when I broke away from The Escapist many years ago, parent company Defy Media seemed very concerned that I'd turn around and badmouth them. Frankly, it wasn't worth my time to talk about what a cluelessly run company it was, especially as it was spiraling towards its inevitable death, which came in 2018. But non-disparagement clauses nonetheless encourage a chilling effect. While a company can accurately claim that it wants to protect against unfair disparagement, it has the convenient side effect of shutting up any fair disparagement too. And some might argue that it's less a side effect and more the intended goal. In the wake of the Riot expose, workers have begun the embryonic stages of true organization, the kind of organization we need to see if we want the game industry to improve. Over 150 Riot employees recently staged a walkout to protest the company's forced arbitration policy, a policy that is itself rooted deep within this culture of silence we talked about. Forced arbitration prevents employees from filing suit against the company, instead having to argue their case with, well, an arbitrator, as the name would suggest. This means current workers at Riot cannot take the company to court, which not only keeps Riot legally off the hook, but helps keep a lid on any negativity. If stories of abuse and discrimination are kept behind closed doors at arbitration, we sure as shit don't get to hear the details. It's telling that Riot, which is apparently trying to improve its workplace in the wake of Kotaku's story, has exempted new hires from forced arbitration, while current employees, those who had worked in a reportedly more toxic environment and therefore would be more likely to have complaints, don't have the same freedom to take their issues to a courtroom. Oh, funny how that works out. Indeed, this latest spat all started because Riot refused to allow two of its staff to take them to court. And the company's admitted it wants to avoid highly publicized lawsuits, as well as ones it deems frivolous. For the record, arbitration rarely goes in favor of the worker with the complaint, an overwhelming number of these disputes working to benefit the company, not the individual. No wonder corporations love them. Which itself should be a red flag. If a corporation loves something, there's a better than small chance that the thing in question only benefits the corporation and has no advantages whatsoever for real human beings. The organizers of the walkout stress their protest is against Riot's policy, not Riot itself. Unfortunately, Riot has ignored the walkout, stating,
"Given the complexities of ongoing litigation, we will not change our employee agreements while in active litigation."
Essentially refusing hundreds of concerned staffers. This is utter bullshit, in my opinion. Victims of harassment, mistreatment, and discrimination should not be blocked from sharing their stories and from seeking genuine legal recompense if required. Silence is a petri dish for abuse. It's where it thrives and it needs to be broken. Forced arbitration is a scumbag policy enforced by scumbags, in my personal opinion, and it only ever looks like a deliberate attempt to sew the mouth shut of anyone with a grievance. I know the walkouts were not protesting Riot Games as a company, but the way Riot talks about its workforce should set off alarm bells for anyone who's dealt with a corporation that goes out of its way to enforce loyalty and encourage the closing of ranks whenever a negative story emerges. You see, Riot doesn't call its employees employees. Oh no, it calls them rioters! This insistent terminology is a form of uniform for companies that don't mandate actual uniforms. Rather than get everyone dressing the same, it instead puts the uniform on a person's very identity, which is something I absolutely never trust. When I hear a company calling its staff by a collective brand name, I instantly think of cults. And just look at some startup CEOs out there, cult of personality is their whole fucking bag. In fact, Riot is reported to have what's called a mantra of trust, where you're supposed to always believe that any bad actors in the company have good intentions, and therefore must not be scrutinized too closely. This is another idea that has potential merit with a sinister side effect. It's obviously good to want to trust your colleagues and feel their hearts are in the right place, but when higher-ups dismiss complainers for not having enough faith in their discriminators, it undermines the very notion of constructive criticism. Again, it could just be a side effect, but it's a tantalizingly appealing feature for any company that wants to silence its critics. The irony of a mantra of trust is I would never trust any company with one. I tend to trust things that have earned trust, not things that demand trust. Attempting to report on unjust behavior in the game industry has always been difficult for these reasons and more. Game developers are terrified of vengeful and litigious companies that maintain a suppressive atmosphere throughout the industry. Not only are people scared of their former employers coming after them, they're equally worried that speaking up will stop other companies hiring them in future. Essentially, it's a huge gamble and a potential death mark on one's career to speak up against mistreatment, neglect, and harassment. I'm currently trying to dig into stories myself regarding mismanagement at a number of game publishers, but because so few people are willing to come forward, and fewer still want their identities anywhere near the story, it's often difficult to even know where to start. But incidentally, if any game developers know that talkative chap known as Bob Every Guy in certain circles, hit me up. This fog of silence helps push back against unionization as well. After all, if few people are speaking up and those that do are largely anonymous, then how can people communicate and share their stories and get organized? We don't even need the more serious allegations to know that Riot wants it quiet. Their forced arbitration, keeping a lid on so-called rioters, and blocking at least two potential legal battles do enough to demonstrate how they prioritize discretion over fairness. The allegations nonetheless serve to paint a very clear picture as to why, the moment the stitching is pulled from people's lips, some very dark words come out. And I fear this won't be the last or the worst of it, not just for Riot, but the industry overall. Between CEOs like Randy Pitchford tied up in physical assault allegations and stories of burnout and breakdowns running rampant across the game's business, it's clear that gaming has a massive closet with a veritable orgy of skeletons inside. The silence is starting to break and the truth is starting to out. It's quite clear that game companies confidently feel they hold all the cards and can act with impunity, and for the longest time, that's been true. But that truth needs to change, because this cannot continue. The game industry needs kicking onto its back, and we need to see all the slime and the muck and the filth that cakes its underbelly, because it's there. There's more of it than you want to know, and we've all been smelling it for quite some time. We need to see it all. Whether we want to or not, we need to. And before all's said and done, I predict a riot.
So, I'm Dan Platt for the Three Left Show. You just listened to a video by Jim Sterling, who covers video games and the video game industry, about unionization there. So, just to follow up on that story about Riot employees walking out on about, you know, sexual harassment and their ability to actually be to litigate that. Now, that is actually a process that many, many companies, including the military, you know, many rapes that occur in the military and foreign service are covered up because they are not actually allowed to litigate, or rather they are used to force arbitration, and thus, or, you know, even if it gets reported. So there's that. Now, on the gaming side, with gaming unionizing the workers, there also needs to be unionization of gamers themselves as well, because there's a lot of exploitation, and as well as with any consumable industry. Gaming is just still growing. Maybe it's plateaued. There's always kind of talk of it, is it going to crash again, because it's just slowing down. But, I mean, that's entertainment in general. That's the economy in general. It really is all bind together. The organization that was helping the workers at Riot Games, the Rioters, as the company calls them, as Jim explained, there's Game Workers Unite, a grassroots advocacy group that helped Monahan and other rioters organize the walkout and offered a letter of solidarity and support of the action. And it's quickly grown from a private conversation on a game chat server in March of last year to an organization with 800 active members and 17 chapters in North America one year later. Game Workers Unite wants to help those inside the industry organize at a time when the industry's anti-worker practices are finally getting more media attention, such as stories of overwork and abuse at Rockstar Games, makers of Grand Theft Auto, among other things, during their making of their latest, Red Dead Redemption 2, which is the ultimate cowboy simulator. Video game companies are rife with long hours, poor treatment, and a race to the bottom in terms of opportunistic employers who, according to Game Workers Unite, quote, encourages workers to sell their craft for the lowest they can just to be in the industry they love. Maybe this might relate to you. Monahan believes that the walkout will spark other actions, both at Riot and throughout the tech and games industry. Even if we wanted it to be the end, we kind of started a lot of stuff. I don't see this dying down anytime soon, and I don't want it to die down. Last quote. I hope other folks at other game companies are having these same conversations. I think no matter how the issue of forced arbitration goes at Riot, what we did was make people realize they're a part of a community, this community, and we as workers have the power to make change collectively if we're loud enough. Mm-hmm. And that's usually the case with any kind of activism, being loud enough and being direct and impactful. So here is, so I'm going to continue on with another organizing labor story. This one is kind of local to New York, but has import across the country as well, since we all eat food, right? Court rules New York farm workers have a right to organize. Now, I think there's been a farm labor bill in the works to grant farm workers actual rights, because at the moment they really don't. They actually don't have right to a bathroom break or whatever, and all the protections that you assume that a worker has, whatever employee you are. So this is reported by Mallory Mensch. This is from Times Union. This is the Albany, New York paper. It's a Hearst paper. Farmworkers in New York have the right to organize and collectively bargain, according to a state appeals court Thursday, and said an exclusion for farm workers in the state labor law is unconstitutional. So while they're working on a legislative approach, which is usually always held up by lobbyists, and of course just a no-go area for the most part, sometimes you get progress by suing. And thus, you know, you have to collect a lot of money for that as well. So that itself is an organizational challenge, raising the money for lawyers or having the activist lawyers help you. The opinion from the appellate division of the state Supreme Court sided with the legal argument of labor activists who say that farm workers have labor rights. Well, you know. In a 4-1 ruling, the justices reversed a lower... These are activist judges. The justices reversed a lower court's conclusion that farm workers were excluded from the state collective bargaining rules. Why did they think that? Thursday's opinion called that exclusion unconstitutional as a matter of law. New York Farm Bureau, the defendant, released a statement from its president, Dave Fisher, that said the organization fully intends to appeal the court's ill-conceived ruling. How dare they grant farm workers rights? We believe that the majority's conclusion is unsupportable and disregards decades of precedent. It's the way it's always been. How could it not be? Since the 30s, farm workers have been excluded by a provision carved out in the State Employment Relations Act, which the plaintiffs in the case argued was designed to discriminate against black workers during the Jim Crow era. No duh. Crispin Hernandez, a farm worker who claimed he was fired from his job on a dairy farm in Lewis County for trying to organize in pursuit of better working conditions, challenged the law. This is interesting, because usually one is not protected from being fired when one is organizing, since it's a political reason, and, you know, those kind of human rights, as far as protections, as a protected class, political classes are not protected, you know, via the First Amendment, which means you can be fired for organizing. The suit was dismissed in January of 2018 by the state Supreme Court Justice Richard Nally Jr., who ruled the law was not discriminatory. Hernandez appealed last year. Yeah, so basically you do your first case, whether or not a judge rules one way or another, you appeal, and then it goes up to the next level. This is a victory for farm workers, as we have finally had our day in court. They've never had one before, I guess. But I can believe that. I can. Hernandez said Thursday, all workers deserve to have a voice and be heard at their place of work, and farm workers deserve to be treated with respect and dignity. When the case was filed in 2016, Governor Cuomo's administration said it didn't want to fight it. On Thursday, Cuomo and Attorney General Lovetta James applauded the decision. Weird, they don't seem to take action as far as creating rights through the legislation. That is something they could push for. And this is the first this has been reported as far as progress on this issue. I'm not going to read Cuomo's. He's a ghoul, and I don't want to read his words. But basically, he's grandstanding, saying, oh, I was for this all along, even though I didn't lift a goddamn finger. He does that with fracking. He does that with gay marriage. That was totally something he had to be forced into. The Farm Bureau's appellate court filings argue that the government did not extend collective bargaining rights to farm workers because laborers who choose to strike during picking season could financially cripple farmers. Well, that's the point, you doof. The Bureau also said the solution should be addressed in the state legislature, which has failed to address the question despite years of advocacy. Well, of course. They say, look, this isn't something for the courts. This should be decided in legislators. You know, the ones we own, the ones where we give money to all of the legislators, and of course, always swing our way or kill any legislation in committee. Because obviously, that's how things are done in our, quote, democracy. The Farm Workers Fair Labor Practices Act, so this is the thing that's stuck in the Senate in New York, which would give farm workers the right to unionize and guarantee a day off, because they don't have a guaranteed day off, as well as overtime pay, there's no overtime pay, has been introduced repeatedly over the past 2 decades, but has never passed. This year, the bill is gaining finally momentum after Democratic takeover of the Senate, thanks to DSA and other types of progressive activists. And 3 hearings were held across the state recently to discuss the measure. And that's the difference between having actual, like, support in a legislator or actually having momentum, is that there's actually hearings to discuss it so that they actually do work out the kinks of a proposed bill so that it will actually be passed. You can get as many co-sponsors as you want, but unless they're actually holding hearings to, like, actually educate themselves, because, get this, legislators actually don't know a lot. They're really blank slates. I mean, I think this is how a lot of voters and people want them to be. They want them to be blank slates, so they can just either project their needs or tell them what they want, and they do it. That's what most legislators actually are. They don't actually have their own positions. I know we want them to have their own policies. We want to vote for policies and platforms, not just people, but the way American politics works in the minds of independents and, you know, the standard voter, I guess, is I want a blank slate and not policies, and basically someone who will carry out the policies, because, hey, we're in a liberal democracy and there's all these other interests. And we want things to be fair, so we can't just elect someone who's biased for farm workers or something like that. But someone who just does what, like, the majority or whoever's loud enough does. And apparently that is the quote-unquote best system we can have. I disagree. We need direct democracy. Grassroots assemblies that then carry up legislation to delegates, who, in delegate, difference between delegate and representative, is a delegate has instructions on what they're allowed to do and not do. Representative is apparently given carte blanche, or full permission to represent, quote-unquote, tens of thousands of people at a time, who have diverse politics and opinions, and they simply are chosen based on a small minority who come out once on a one day. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, labor advocates point to the close to $5 billion the state's farms generated in revenue in 2017 as evidence that farmers can afford to increase worker pay. Angela Cornwell, director of the Labor Law Clinic at Cornell Law School, described the court's decision as a step forward for some of the most vulnerable workers in our communities. The language in the Constitution is very clear. It's without qualification. Employees have the right to organize and bargain. The Farm Bureau, this is the, you know, the capitalists, have highlighted census data that shows a continued reduction in the number of farms in New York and the state's average net farm income of $42,000, which is below the national average. So this is also a difference of small dairy farms and small farmers who are just kind of mom-and-pop operations. It's always struggling and basically do make like maybe $40,000 on a good year, which, you know, is a median income. They're not making bank. But there's also the really large farms that use migrant labor and as well as just... In 2017 report by a worker center in Central New York and the Worker Justice Center, New York found that 69 farm workers died while working in the New York dairy industry. So almost 69 people die working in the industry, and because they don't have protections, like what can you do? There's no safety, I guess. Cornell said that aside from a pay raise, workers will now be able to negotiate for things like safer working conditions. The workers, if they decide to organize, it will give them the opportunity to have a seat at the table and negotiate over things that are important, like health, safety, issues, as well as housing. Because otherwise your commute is pretty long. We shouldn't deny fundamental rights to workers because we are concerned that potentially there could be an incremental increase in expenditures at farms. It's always the case that business has opposed every single piece of employment legislation in all of history. They say decades, but hey. Mario Clientel, president of the New York State AFL-CIO, I'll get back to them in a moment, has applauded the appellate court's decision upholding the state constitution and affirming in this state organizing that they cannot be denied. Farm workers deserve to be treated fairly and with dignity and respect. Clientel said in a statement, allowing them to join unions the first step to the right direction to give them a voice on the job. Now I'm going to follow up, and I'll link in the post show, whether like when I share this edited podcast, that the AFL-CIO nationally, it's been leaked in their new budget that they've cut the budget for their spending for organizing down to 10%. I think it was like 40%. Now it's 10%. So they, as a organization, are not going to be actually doing outreach and organizing anymore. They're saying explicitly internally that they're just going to focus on lobbying court decisions like these and lobbying and spending money on political campaigns, which in the long run has been their downfall. It enrages me. It is how they have utterly failed my age group, my age bracket, millennials and Zoomers. And I've told them to their face when I've been interviewed as a candidate twice for PEF, which is the Professional Employees Federation. That's state workers, the white collar ones in the cubicles. And I basically told them, like, the second time I was a little madder, that you failed us. You don't outreach. And this is specifically because I was working as a seasonal state worker and I had basically been phased out, downsized, and the union did nothing. They had no voice. They were powerless to stop the process of doing more of less, as the governor put it, which is why I hate him, and taking that job away from me, pretty much. It was pretty good. I liked having it. I was visited by the state rep, the union rep, twice in my 3 to 4 years, maybe even 6 years of being there. See, we were seasonal workers. We were college students. For the most part, I was post-grad, but point was, we weren't seen as, like, you know, legitimate members, even though we were all paying dues. We were all paying dues, but, and this is a general thing with unionizing, or existing business unions, because these are business unions, which are, should not be, they shouldn't be taken seriously anymore. And now, like, they're basically saying, we just want access to the president, whoever the president is, or the Congress, and we don't actually want to organize. So it doesn't matter if we have the right to organize if there isn't the infrastructure to help people organize. And if not these people, the AFL-CIO, which is the big labor organization, then who? There's the IWW, but they're very small in grassroots, and that's why they stay small. And I can talk about them another time, but generally I just want to get across what a failure the quote-unquote labor movement has been. And that even though this is a piece of good news I'm relating about this court decision, just winning through, you know, just the court, that farm workers can now organize. Can they organize? They can organize legally, but can they materially, functionally, practically organize? Maybe, maybe not. I think the people, I mean, there's tons of advocates, and those advocates are made up of organic leaders from farm workers. So those are the people who are going to be leading the charge to now organize. In their niches or at their workplace. So the next story, covering labor issues for is from Vice, of course, is sex work is work and its laborers are officially unionizing. This story is from the UK, not America, but we'll get there here. In the UK, sex workers are joining with trade unions to demand better collective conditions for their industry. Jake Hall, April 17th. Understandably, it's pretty difficult to start a union when parts of your industry are criminalized by the state. But that hasn't stopped British sex workers from unionizing in order to fight for their labor rights, even with the web of contradictory laws around it. In England, it's legal exchange sex for money, but street-based workers are often criminalized through loitering and soliciting laws. Brothels themselves are illegal, but an overly generous legal definition of brothel means that sex workers can also be raided and persecuted for sharing premises, even if they're doing so for their own protection, which is the case. Campaign groups and collectives like Decrim Now and Swarm are calling for full decriminalization. Not that it needs to be legalized, but simply don't criminalize the work anymore. But in the meantime, strippers, whose work is entirely legal, are unionizing in the hopes of sparking industry-wide change. The idea for a strippers union came last year in Women's Strike, in which sex workers played an instrumental role. Quoting, "It literally just started with a conversation. Her name is Shirley Shamley, a representative of trade union United Voices of the World. As she recalls, we soon found that strippers are often misclassified as self-employed, but in reality they're expected to be on time, to follow a shift pattern, and to be told what they can earn, or in some cases, lose." She's referring to the house fees that are commonplace in strip clubs. Dancers can also be fined for not showing up to shifts. And Shalini says anecdotally that she knows of dancers who have been fired for trying to unionize, which is always anecdotal because the reporting is always very spotty on it. There needs to be more labor journalists. But Vice, at least, is doing some of the work. Shalini herself is not a dancer. She reports the strippers union as part of her role at the UVW. That's what worker solidarity means. Most sex workers are truly independent, but from a trade union perspective, it makes sense to start with workers who can organize inside an actual workplace. We're entirely led by members. We don't tell them what to do, and we don't assume we know the industry better than they do. What we do provide is the legal support and the organizing experience. Louise, a dancer herself and member of this union, tells Broadly, "I think pretty much every dancer has experienced discrimination at some point. It's the same as being a woman in any workplace." She lists a number of examples. Clubs turning away dancers of color because they already have enough. a lack of support for dancers dealing with personal issues, and casual, repeated body shaming from both managers as well as clients. Luis has to use her stripple name, as she is not out with her friends and family. It's worth noting that these problems aren't unique to strip clubs. The English Collective of Prostitutes has authored an extensive research report, they have done their own research, proving that jobs commonly thought of women's work tend to be highly exploitative. What else is new, but let's change that. But that doesn't mean that's not worth trying to fix them. That's where unions can come in. What's beautiful about organizing is that we want better conditions for all of our fellow dancers, says Louise. She describes in an informal sisterhood fighting collectively for their rights, a battle which has already yielded some victories. Better still, a handful of strip clubs seem to be actively listening. They're consulting with workers and hiring staff to manage their concerns. In Scotland, a recent vote to develop a version of the so-called Nordic model, which is widely criticized because it criminalized clients, but not the workers. So basically, those who buy the services are criminalized. They can be arrested and fined because it's so immoral to indulge or to buy the services of a sex worker. But we're not going to be so judgy about the sex workers because we want to be good feminists. And this has led to sex workers unionizing with the support of a trade union, GMB Scotland. Organizer Rhea Wolfson explains that the new legislation was the main catalyst. Sex workers joined to organize fellow workers to fight against these laws, which put their safety at risk. Our aim is to show that sex work is work and to fight for a legislative framework which gives those workers access to those same rights that we all rely on. Another, Megra Furry, also played a key role in fighting for unionization. If you criminalize clients, it's not going to end demand, she outlined in an interview with the Evening Times. All it does is remove any safeguards that we have. She shares the sentiment that decriminalization is the best way to protect workers. It's been proven and highly effective in New Zealand, and as a result, the union welcomes self-employed sex workers in its fight for this change, legislative change. It's an unconventional but pragmatic approach to fighting these laws that isolate these workers. Isolation breeds danger, okay? And that means all the sex trafficking woes. And it's a minor point, but there's a shared with me that frames something as being about sex trafficking. So basically there was a sweep, a big police sweep in the Detroit area. And the headline was like 120 children recovered and found. So these are all missing children, many missing children. But the headline is like 120 children recovered in relation to sex trafficking, which might bring to mind a warehouse full of child sex slaves or many, many outfits. Like, it is truly a big, serious problem. Not that it isn't a serious problem, but some amazingly large, underground, just out of sight, but everywhere problem of sex trafficking. But in the text of the article, it said that out of the 120, three were related to actual sex trafficking. All the other missing kids were runaways or various other situations where the main guardian just didn't know where the kid was. But like, say they were staying with someone else, they went somewhere else, or they didn't want to be with their guardian. Many different situations, many different possibilities. One of which is they were kidnapped in the underground economy. Three of those cases existed. So those are serious, prosecutable, and it's a good thing they were recovered. But when it comes to the dangers of sex trafficking, it doesn't seem to be random women off the street or something like that, but it is the women in the sex industry who are at risk. And they're at risk exactly because they are not protected by the law, or they are criminalized even. They are put also at danger from the law. They are not unionized, so they do not have any protection or organization, no infrastructure, no defense. And the laws themselves isolate them, which of course puts them in danger and risk. And that is, so if you want to end sex trafficking, which we've taken the opposite direction in America, we have passed, it was called CRISPA. Yeah, CRISPA and CISPA, which are these laws which basically further isolated sex workers by criminalizing them and trying to get to crush the underground prostitution economy. Because that's how sex trafficking is. It depends on the ability to sell. But you basically just crushed the independent woman-led economy, where there was the women who were in charge of it, the women who were selling, the women who were organizing it independently, being entrepreneurs. And you basically just really, you crushed them. And now they have to go to pimps. They have to, you know, which are slave drivers. Then they have to be sex slaves. Then they are at risk of being gobbled up. This happened to an anonymous, I will say, someone in my Facebook circles. And she's a dancer. And so she was at risk and she got away from it, but she was drugged. She was assaulted, raped. That's the reality. Not 120 kids being sex trafficked around over the border or whatever. And a wall's going to fix it. Okay. A grievance shared by both unions is that sex workers of all varieties are often told they're self-employed when they legally aren't considered as such. It's a workforce that doesn't consider itself a workforce, explained Shamley, who cites Uber and Deliveroo, delivery drivers, as well. That's no coincidence. It's a deliberate political move, to deprive workers of their rights. It's part of a wider neoliberal move to destroy our communities. Bingo. Similar sex worker unions are cropping up across the world. Ortrez is a particularly high-profile example. Spanish union initially had its registration approved by the government, but swift political backlash led to the decision being revoked on the basis that prostitution doesn't legally qualify as work. Dutch sex workers union, Proud, is currently organizing to protest the recent ban on the red light district tours in Amsterdam. Outside of Europe, countries like Argentina have extensive histories of sex worker unionization. The same can't be said for North America, far Puritan roots. The most up-to-date research suggests that numerous attempts to achieve trade union recognition for sex work has largely failed, though vital NGOs like SWAP, Sex Workers Outreach Project, that's the main one, continue to fight for justice and wider safety. The general consensus among unions is that this approach no longer works. The approach of sit down with the bosses and talk it out. Trade unions in the UK have a specific history. They've struggled to thrive since the ravaging of the 80s with Margaret Thatcher. The smaller bodies have been swallowed up by the larger, more powerful entities. They have been deliberately destroyed. So as bigger unions essentially become service unions, the political rhetoric became sit down with the bosses and talk to them. This is across the board. This is the business unions I've worked with when I had my grocery job. The general consensus among unions is that this approach no longer works. Gradual shift towards, and it's not consensus among union leadership, apparently. But this next generation of unionization is certainly going to have more radical politics. Gradual shifts towards zero-hour contracts have made workplace rights the exception as opposed to the rule. As a result, unions have become more vocal and more demanding. New trade unions are successful and they're growing rapidly. Telling me that the UVW gained 124 members in the last month alone. We've injected a new kind of politics into our trade unions. It's not about asking for small reforms and tiny improvements. It's about saying we have been robbed, cheated, and not just out of our wages, but are out of our collective power. So we are not going to ask. We demand. Hear, hear. So I'm going to run out the hour. This has been the Three Left Show. Website is threelefts.news. That is it. No www, just threelefts.news. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, but I've been slow to upload things. Please contact me. I am podcasted on all the main apps. I also have a Patreon. If you'd like to support materially, I certainly currently don't have any patrons, but I would love your support. Money for outreach, money for security to support this hobby of mine. As well, and help it grow into maybe something substantial. I'm always kind of in the middle. But, hey, maybe enough support can get me to go take the next step. All right. Thank you very much.